Well, as you recall, nearly 4 years ago, about 160 miles away from us, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was shot and killed by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch volunteer. Martin was unarmed. Zimmerman was charged and tried in Martin's death, and a jury acquitted Zimmerman of second-degree murder and manslaughter in July of 2013. Alicia Garza was watching television in Oakland, California, in a bar with her friends when the news of the acquittal was broadcast. In response to the news, Garza wrote on her Facebook that Black Lives Matter. This phrase that she wrote spread quickly because it expressed the feelings of many people. It is a simple, it is positive, it is easy to remember. Black Lives Matter. The phrase reasserts the importance of recognizing African American lives as part of the common good of America. It has become a decentralized protest movement that has grown across our country. A year later, in July of 2014, 43-year-old Eric Garner, an unarmed African-American man, died in Staten Island, New York City, after a New York City Police Department officer put him in a chokehold for about 15 seconds while arresting him. A friend of Garner's recorded the incident on a cell phone. A month later, in August of 2014, in Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was fatally shot by a Ferguson police officer. Other killings of unarmed African-Americans have been documented in the past year. The word Black Lives Matter has been heard over and over again. The slogan appears on posters, on t-shirts, and churches started to post it on their signs. In December of 2014, we put these words, Black Lives Matter, on our church sign. After it was up for a time, we took the words down and replaced it with our usual announcements of concerts and sermons. Now, back in December of 2014, our sign was not vandalized. However, several Unitarian Universalist congregations who put up Black Lives Matter signs have had them vandalized. You see four examples on the cover of the Order of Service, and there are many more. Some vandals have replaced the word black with the word all lives matter. Some have replaced the word black with the word white. White Lives Matter. Some have removed the word black, leaving only the words Lives Matter. Obviously, this phrase has raised strong feelings. Is it appropriate to single out one group in our culture? Should we really say all lives matter? I've heard this argument in a different context years ago. In the 1980s, when gay activists called for more funds for research for the treatment of AIDS, I heard a few people say, "What about the other serious illnesses? Why do you only care about AIDS? Why do you not call for more funding to cure all diseases?" And when women activists started campaigning for more research funds for breast cancer, I heard the same comment, "Well, what about all the other cancers? Why do you only care about curing breast cancer?" We are afraid that if other causes are successful in getting more attention, the causes that we care about will lose out. This is possible. In human communities, whether it's Sarasota or Florida or the United States or the world, in human communities, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. The loudest problems are the ones that get the most attention. It is necessary, therefore, for each of us to look at the facts and decide if the emotional, if the this emotional issue deserves our attention, or is it something that we should ignore? Now, documenting racial profiling is not easy because a multitude of factors, including elevated violent crime rates in many black neighborhoods, makes it hard to separate evidence of racial bias from other influences. The news stories of police killing unarmed African Americans, these stories are dramatic. They are tragic. They affect us emotionally. But they could simply be isolated events and not the sign of a pattern. The best evidence is in statistics. Over a year ago, journalists realized that in the United States, there was no central accounting for the number of people who are killed by police. The average annual number of police killings each year was estimated by the FBI at about 400. So starting in January of 2015, The Guardian newspaper and The Washington Post, working separately, tried to document police killings during the year 2015. Now, The Washington Post only looked at situations where police used a firearm, used a gun, a shooting. And this is the conclusion. Although black men make up only 6% of the United States population, they account for 40% of the unarmed men shot to death by police this year. The Guardian newspaper looked at all the deaths caused by police, not just shooting. So it would include the Eric Gardner death, where the man was held by his throat. According to the Guardian, in 2015, 1,134 people in the United States died at the hands of law enforcement officers. Young black men were 9 times more likely than other Americans to be killed by police officers in 2015. Despite making up only 2% of the total United States population, African American males between the ages of 15 and 34 comprised more than 15% of all deaths by police. Young African American males' rate of police-involved deaths was 5 times higher than for white men of the same age. In 2015, black people were killed at twice the rate of white, Hispanic, and Native Americans. About 25% of African Americans killed were unarmed, compared with 17% of white people. Now, again, documenting racial profiling is difficult because there are many factors, including the elevated violent crime rates in many black neighborhoods, that make it hard to tease out evidence of racial bias from other influences. Nevertheless, this data does suggest that there is a serious problem. Shortly after President Obama took office in July of 2009, an African American and a Harvard professor, Henry Louis Gates Jr., returning from a trip, found the front door to his home jammed shut. With the help of his driver, the two of them tried to force that front door of his home open. A local police officer responded to a 911 caller's report of men breaking and entering the residence. Professor Gates was arrested for the crime of entering his own home. In the days that followed, President Obama invited both the police officer and the professor to the White House to discuss the issue over beer. Afterwards, the professor was asked about his opinion of the police officer. Professor Gates said, "We hit it off right from the beginning. When he's not arresting you, Sergeant Crawley is a really likable guy. Now, not all such racial profiling ended with a reconciliation. After the killer of Trayvon Martin was acquitted in July of 2013, President Obama talked about the racial fear in our country. The president said, "You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said, this could have been my son." Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me, the president, 35 years ago. And when you think about why in African-American, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important, said the president, to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me, said the president. There are very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, said the president, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. It's good to have a president who understands the issue firsthand from the perspective of an African American. Whatever the color of our skin, if we live in this society, we have an obligation to try to understand the experience of African Americans. Now, at the same time, whatever the color of our skin, we need to understand the perspective of law enforcement. And here in Florida, I have seen a bumper sticker on the back of a car that says, "Police Lives Matter." And this is very true. I have also visited the Law Enforcement Memorial in Washington, D.C. There are granite walls at that memorial that hold the names of nearly 22,000 police officers, women and men of all races, of all religions, including Unitarian Universalists, who have died in the line of duty serving as law enforcement officers. Early in my ministry, I went on a 10-hour ride along in a police car with a police officer in Lexington, Kentucky. Now, before I went on the ride along, there was actually a group of clergy, and we went to the police department and said, "We need to know more about what your experience is like. We would like to ride on." And they say, "Well, before you do that, we're going to have you take a class and learn about what it's like to be a police officer." So we spent a day, a whole group of about 30 clergy in Lexington, Kentucky. We were taught by a police officer about the dangers that officers face and how they train to avoid them. We watched and discussed training movies that reenacted actual events, such as when police officers were shot approaching a car for a traffic violation. We were told that if we wanted to do a ride-along, we needed to learn to think like a police officer, to view everyone we encountered, as someone who might suddenly try to kill us. In my 10-hour ride-along, we investigated a $10,000 jewel theft in a hotel parking lot. I learned from that that when you unpack your car at a hotel parking lot and carry your luggage into the room, do not leave your car unlocked as you're doing that. We helped a woman who had lost her keys break into her house, not unlike what Professor Gates went through, but we helped her rather than arrest her. We investigated a hit-and-run automobile crash, and this was the most interesting. Someone had seen the hit-and-run and had written down the license number of the car. So from that, we got the address. We went to that house, and we could see a man in the front part of the house passed out on the couch. We pounded on the door, and he didn't wake up. He was clearly had had way too much to drink. There had been no injuries in this hit-and-run. He had just simply sideswiped the car and then driven on. We asked the station man, the police officer who was the supervisor over the radio, for permission to knock down the door and take this drunk and put him in the police car and take him to jail. And they wouldn't give us permission to enter, so we left him there. But I learned about the difficulties of what it is like to be a police officer. When we weren't busy, we talked 10 hours together. This man said, "I have no friends who are not police officers. When I go to a social event," he said, "and someone asks me, what do I do for a living? And I tell them, they all treat me differently. I am treated as separate. I am treated as apart from all the others at the event. Only when I am with other police do I feel like I am treated like a normal person. Because of our role, police are isolated from the rest of the community." I learned that night how isolated this police officer felt. He felt separate from the community of people that he protected. Now, if this church were broken into, I would call the police. If someone tried to disrupt this worship service, several of you, I hope, would call 911. I am enormously grateful for those men and women who are willing to serve as police officers and who do their best to keep order in our community. So my sermon title this morning is Black Lives Matter and Police Lives Matter. I'm able to hold both of those statements in my mind and not feel a contradiction. They are both important. They are both true. In November of 2014 in Cleveland, Ohio, a 12-year-old African-American boy with a realistic replica of a toy gun was shot and killed by police. Now, if you study this gun, it's designed to be a replica of a real gun. It has an orange taping around it to make it look like it's a toy gun rather than a real gun, but those orange tapings can be easily removed. And this gun, those had been removed. So the police came up to him, and what they saw was a real weapon. And they killed this 12-year-old child. This child's lives mattered. But I remember my ride-on experience. I remember how I was taught to view everyone we encountered as someone who might try to kill us. There are so many guns in America. It is tragic. It is terribly tragic and sad, but not surprising that a police officer mistook a replica gun, a toy gun, for a real gun. In 2015, 1,134 people in the United States died at the hand of law enforcement officers. This simply does not happen in other countries. In 2015, in the United Kingdom of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, the number was 3. 3. Now, their population is about 70 million, and ours is 318 million. But even if you do the math, 3 is much smaller than over 1,000. The total number of citizens killed by law enforcement officers in Canada in the past year was 22. And again, the population of Canada is, 25 million? So even if you do the math, of 25 million compared to 318 million. 22 is still a significantly lower number than our country. A difference is the number of guns in the United States compared to Canada or the United Kingdom. Because there are so many guns in America, American police have good reason to be afraid. And because our police are afraid, civilians, especially young African-American males, they have reason to be afraid of the police. The solution is fewer guns. It will be many years before the number of guns in our country decreases. Still, I have hope. The attention that is being given to this problem as a result of the widespread use of cameras, with the images posted on the World Wide Web, and with the willingness of our newspapers and our television news to draw attention to the issue, all of this helps us make progress. Many people in our society, including churches, call for accountability and call for reforms. All of this is good. So on this Sunday, as we celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I want to close with some words from the President of the United States, words of hope. Let's watch the video.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country. And so, you know, we have to be vigilant and we have to work on these issues, and those of us in authority should be doing everything we can to encourage the better angels of our nature as opposed to using these episodes to heighten divisions. But we should also have confidence that kids these days, I think, have more sense than we did back then, and certainly more than our parents did or our grandparents did, and that along this long, difficult journey, you know, we're becoming a more perfect union. Not a perfect union, but a more perfect union.
A more perfect union.